Melissa Harris Perry. This is The Takeaway. And this is one of the most important musical tracks ever made.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood, in your neighborhood. Say, who are the people in your neighborhood? The people that you meet each day.
Who are the people in your neighborhood? I mean, for more than 50 years, the Sesame Workshop has asked this question as it teaches its young viewers about the many different professions, trades, jobs, and gigs that contribute to the vibrant ecosystem of community. So, how would you respond to the question? Who are the people in your neighborhood? Are you from Chicago's South Side?
It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Do you rep the 504? Are you Brooklyn, born and bred?
Brooklyn!
Or are you straight out of Compton? A big part of our identities is it's rooted in the places where we live and the people who live near us. But there's a community identity that you rarely hear people reference in order to explain who they are. Congressional district. I can't think of any film where the tough guy gangster says, "Don't mess with me, I'm from Nevada's 3rd Congressional District." Or any country music ballad with a nostalgic chorus extolling Tennessee's 5th Congressional District. Even the most educated and civic-minded among us would have a pretty hard time correctly identifying the district of our state house or state senate. Yet these political neighborhoods are foundational to so many aspects of our lives. Depending on the district where you live, your political voice can be drowned out, or it can be echoed, or amplified. Right now, we are in the thick of redistricting efforts. Lawmakers across the country are using 2020 census data to determine the boundaries of your political neighborhood for the next decade. And this year, it is Republicans who stand to gain the most. Republicans control 30 state legislatures, Democrats only 18, and then there are two that are split. And it is in those state legislatures where most redistricting happens. Republicans only need to gain 5 seats to win a majority in the House of Representatives in the 2022 midterms. And here is Republican Representative Ronnie Jackson from Texas at the Faith and Freedom Conference in June.
We have everything working in our favor right now. We have redistricting coming up, and the Republicans control most of that process in most of the states around the country. That alone should get us the majority back.
So, who are the people in your neighborhood? Well, that might be changing a lot in the next few months. Here with me is Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones. Ari, it's always great to have you here.
Hey, Melissa. Great to talk to you again. And that was one of the more lively intros to a discussion about redistricting.
You gotta keep the people in here with the neighborhood. But honestly, I find it, and I know that you do, because we're sort of nerds on this, like deeply interesting and compelling and stressful. When I hear Ronnie Jackson say that redistricting alone can get the majority back, that doesn't feel terribly Democratic with a little D to me.
It doesn't feel terribly Democratic because it feels like the election results have already been predetermined before the elections have even begun. And virtually every knowledgeable political commentator believes that Ronnie Jackson is right, that Republicans will be able to gerrymander enough seats to take back the House from that alone, no matter what the national environment is. We published a story at Mother Jones a little while ago based on analysis from a Democratic firm called Target Smart that found that Republicans could pick up anywhere from 6 to 13 seats in just 4 states alone, Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, and Texas, through redistricting. So Republicans are in major control of this process, and by all indications, they're going to be very aggressive in terms of the maps that they're going to draw in these states.
Help me understand this. Some of those states that you named have additional seats allocated to them, additional congressional districts. And that allocation happened largely because of population change over the last 10 years. And that population change mostly had to do with the growth of populations that are typically pretty Democratic. So how is it that Republicans are going to benefit from those new seats?
Well, that's what gerrymandering is all about. It's about manipulating the data to achieve a certain outcome. And there's a paradox here. The paradox is the country is growing because of communities of color. The white population actually shrank, according to the latest census, for the first time since 1790. And you look at a state like Texas, 95% of the population growth is from communities of color. As a result, Texas gained 2 congressional seats, but everyone expects those seats instead are going to go to white Republicans. So you have this paradox that growth is coming for communities of color. Therefore, those seats under fair maps should go to communities of color. Instead, they're going to go to white Republicans who are shrinking demographically, but increasing their numbers politically.
Okay, that just seems counter to sort of the point, right? So you're supposed to count every 10 years, figure out how many Americans there are, divvy up for fair maps. How can you have a fair process if, you know, if a growing population of color turns into a growing population of elected officials who are actually not from those communities? What are some of the alternative ways to draw maps so that they feel more fair?
Well, that's the big difference between redistricting, which is just redrawing the maps to reflect population changes, and gerrymandering, which is manipulating the maps to achieve a partisan or other outcome. And so the alternatives to them are, one, are independent redistricting commissions, which are meant to take the politics out of the process and have been adopted in a number of states. Another thing would be state or federal legislation banning the kind of partisan or racial gerrymandering that is likely to be done in places like Texas. The Freedom to Vote Act, recently introduced by Senate Democrats, for example, would have criteria basically saying you can't draw maps to achieve an unfair partisan or racial advantage, meaning that if lawmakers engage in the kind of gerrymandering that they're very likely to engage in, that there would go before the courts and there would be metrics that the courts would be able to enforce to block these kind of maps. So the alternative is either to try to do it in a way that takes power out of the hands of politicians that are drawing the maps, or puts limits on what the politicians in power can do.
Okay, let's just walk through a few different possibilities. All right, let's say you're trying to increase the opportunity for African Americans in any given state, or Latinos in any given state, to elect representatives who reflect their community. Is it better, right, in that scenario, to A, have maps that mostly put Black folks, even if they're in various cities and sort of not geographically tied to each other, to put them all together into one or maybe two districts? Or is it better to sort of spread those Black or brown folks out and maybe get white Democrats or Democrats who are not as reflective of the community?
Well, this is a robust debate within the Democratic Party right now. For many years, the idea was that you needed a large percentage of minority voters to be able to elect minority candidates. Now there is a changing view that you don't need so many, that Black Democrats, Latino Democrats can get elected from what are known as crossover districts, districts where there may be a majority of minority voters, but there may not be. It may be 40%. Latino or 40% African-American or a mix. In Texas, for example, there's lots of districts that are 15% Asian-American, 20% Black, 20% Latino, and the rest white. And those are electing a minority lawmakers because the country is changing demographically. And we now have coalition districts, right, Melissa, in places like Atlanta, in places like Houston, places like Dallas. It's not one race or ethnicity. It's lots of different ones living together, and not just living in the cities, but now living in the suburbs, in some cases, even the exurbs. And so this is changing. And I think the future of America is multiracial, and the future of districts in these places will also be multiracial. The question is, when it comes to how the lines are drawn, will those communities be kept together, or will they be split apart in such a way that minority voters are dispersed instead of being in one or two congressional districts? They're dispersed among 3, 4, 5 congressional districts, so they don't really have influence in any of them to elect their candidates of choice.
Are there a handful of states or districts that you are watching most closely this time around?
Well, I'm watching the 4 southern states that the Brennan Center for Justice says is at most at risk of extreme partisan and racial gerrymandering, which, as I mentioned earlier, is Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, and Texas. these are states that have engaged in extreme racial and partisan gerrymandering in the past. It's also places where they have full control of the process by Republicans, and they're likely to be very aggressive. It's also places where demographic changes should favor Democrats, but the maps are likely to be drawn in a way that favors Republicans. So those aren't the only states that are going to be doing gerrymandering. There's going to be other Republican-controlled states doing it. There's going to be other Democratic-controlled states like New York, where I live, that are probably going to do it. But those four states in the South, I think, are really the key to what ends up happening, both at the state legislative level and also what ends up happening in terms of control of the U.S. House.
So those states have this great impact both on sort of literally where people live in terms of the districts they're assigned to, and then obviously then who will be elected to Congress. What does that mean for public policy agendas for the current members of Congress who are trying to get some things done before these midterms, and of course for President Biden?
Well, I think for the current members of Congress, they should realize they might not be in the majority much longer. Everyone believes that Republicans are going to take back the U.S. House, probably just through redistricting alone, and certainly redistricting can combined with what is not a great national environment for Democrats, and they only have a 5-seat majority. It certainly seems like the likelihood now is that Democrats are going to lose the House, meaning that Joe Biden won't be able to pass any major pieces of legislation, most likely. So time is running out for Democrats. Time is running out for Democrats to pass legislation writ large. Time is also running out for Democrats to pass the kind of voting rights legislation that would stop the kind of gerrymandering that we're talking about. Because, as I mentioned earlier, the Freedom to Vote Act introduced by Senate Democrats would stop this kind of gerrymandering. But it's only going to stop it if it passes. And it's only going to stop it if it passes before these maps go into effect, which some states have already passed redistricting maps, but most states are going to do it in the coming weeks and months.
What's the likelihood that that we can get that passed, that Democrats can get that passed?
Well, there's no likelihood if they don't alter or reform the filibuster in the Senate. And right now, there are not 50 Democratic votes in the Senate to do that. So there are not 50 Democratic votes to pass voting rights legislation or many other pieces of legislation as a result.
Do you have any optimism about this for the future, Ari?
I have optimism in that people are more aware of it, but that awareness has to translate into legislative action. And so far, there's been an asymmetry between Republicans being very aggressive about their power on the local and state level, but Democrats not being as aggressive about using their power at the federal level.
Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Melissa.
In most states, the state legislature is responsible for creating and approving district maps. But 7 states have nonpartisan independent commissions in charge of the process. In 2018, Colorado voters widely supported 2 constitutional amendments that gave 2 independent commissions the responsibility of determining congressional and state political districts. And due to population growth in Colorado, the state gained an 8th congressional district. 12 commissioners on the Congressional Independent Redistricting Commission are working to determine what the new map will look like. Commissioner Joe Lee Bronner is the vice chair of the Colorado Independent Congressional Redistricting Commission. Thank you for joining us today, Commissioner Bronner.
Thank you so much for having me today, Melissa.
So first, talk to me about how one ends up a commissioner on this independent commission that is different than, for example, being elected to the state house and then drawing these districts.
We applied. I love to tell people that when they see an opportunity like this and they're interested, they should apply. I was nominated for my position and urged to apply by someone I had worked with in the past. And I thought, this sounds like a great idea. Commissioners were selected through this application process. The applications were reviewed by nonpartisan legislative staff and a judicial panel. We then had a judicial panel that randomly selected 300 Democrats, 300 Republicans, and 450 unaffiliated voters to establish a selection pool of just over 1,000 people. And from there, the judicial panel narrowed the selection with input from those legislative leaders. And then they had a lotto-style bingo ball drawing where they drew balls, and we were selected for this commission. The commission is made up of 4 Democrats, for Republicans and for unaffiliated voters.
I love this. It's a, you know, it's a little bit game of chance. It's a little bit democracy, a little bit meritocracy. It's kind of all of those pieces together, the things that we think of as creating some sense of fairness. And so I want to ask, just in the broadest sense, can you just look at a map? You know, if I, let's say I'm not from Colorado and I just pull out the map, you know, put it down and look at it. Can I simply, by looking at the shape of the districts, tell whether or not the map has been drawn in a fair way? And I ask this in part because we talk about gerrymandering as, right, the dragons or the oddly shaped, you know, districts. But I'm wondering, is it absolutely fair to just draw squares, even in a relatively rectangular state like Colorado?
I love that you asked this question, because the word gerrymandering gets thrown around whenever people see those squiggly salamandery lines that the practice is named after. But in all honesty, the reason that we have humans doing this instead of computers is because we're assigning people to districts. So we're not just assigning random boxes in the state of Colorado. We're creating districts that have to be exact in population down to the one person. We have a hierarchy of needs as established by our Constitution, where we have to keep the districts contiguous. We have to keep them equal population. But additionally, it's really important for us to focus on communities of interest. And that's where the human element comes in, and the testimony and input from people around the state and our knowledge of the state. So when we look at a map, the hope is we can look and see those communities and make sure that like communities are with like communities, and communities that work together are together, and communities influenced by federal legislation have a louder voice together in Congress.
Say a little bit more about what a community of interest is. Is that just a sort of a fancy term of art, or is there a way that sort of ordinary folks can go, oh yeah, those are the people in my neighborhood?
It's somewhere in between art and science. The best way I can describe communities of interest is a string kind of analogy. Whereas if you look at a community, there might be a string that ties one agricultural community to a city, that's where everyone shops for their supplies, or that's where everyone goes and knows each other, and that's where their elected representatives are. But again, off that city, there might be a lot of strings that connect it to communities all over the state. And our job as a commission is to find those strings and cut as few of them as possible. It is a sliding scale. There are certain things outlined by the Constitution of what a community interest is supposed to be and what it's not supposed to be. Districts cannot protect incumbents, declared candidates, or any political party, or deny or suppress the right of any citizen to vote on account of that person's race, membership in a language minority group. We still look at it as, what is that human element? So in Colorado, where our people are really spread out, some of our lines look a little squiggly, and that doesn't necessarily mean the dreaded gerrymandering word. What it means is we have mountains and rivers, and people move around those things. And we have huge swaths of public land and federal land and state-controlled land with our great park system, that we need to know where those things are when we're drawing the maps and how those affect federal legislation.
So when you're talking about these communities of interest, how are you all getting input from interested communities?
That is an excellent question. We have several ways that the public can comment on the process. First of all, at any time in the process, people can head over to redistricting.colorado.gov, and they can add their public comment online. They can type up a public comment in our really easy to use form, hit submit, and we get those. We read all of them. Additionally, you can email us those comments, and those written comments are reviewed by staff. But additionally, we have a committee, which I am on, that reviews public comment and presents reports to the full commission to make sure everyone's getting that information in real time and they have access to the full comments. But these reports are helping people contextualize where the comments are coming from. And then we also took this show on the road and did about 36 hearings across our state over the summer. Constitutionally, we were obligated to have 3 hearings in each of our 7 existing congressional districts, which, as you could tell, is only 21 hearings. But as a commission, we felt the input of the public was so important that we added additional hearings just to hear extra input on the process.
Commissioner Jolie Bronner is the vice chair of the Colorado Independent Congressional Redistricting Commission and just gave me a little more faith in how democracy works. Thank you for joining us, Jolie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was delightful.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Let's go to Oklahoma. Originally, this land belonged to Native tribes, including the Comanche, the Apache, the Osage, and the Wichita Nations. Then, in the 1830s, the federal government, under President Andrew Jackson, forced five tribes from the southeastern United States to move thousands of miles away, a deadly journey known as the Trail of Tears. Much of this land was then taken by white settlers in the following decades, and all of that served to lead up to U.S. statehood for Oklahoma in 1907. But today, despite the violence perpetrated by the U.S. government and settlers against the tribes of Oklahoma, Native culture continues to thrive. And on Saturday, the 39 tribes currently based in Oklahoma were finally able to open a museum worthy of their legacy.
Today, the first American's Museum stands as an enduring monument to the persistence and adaptability of those who have lived the longest upon this land called Oklahoma.
That was Dr. Henrietta Mann, a scholar of Native American studies and an enrolled member of the Cheyenne Arapaho tribes, speaking at the opening of the ceremony for the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City. Joining me now is Dr. Heather Ottone, Senior Curator for the First Americans Museum and a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Dr. Ottone, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I feel very privileged to get to speak to your audiences.
So this museum was decades in the making. How are you feeling now that it is open to the public?
I genuinely believe that the ancestors have been holding this in their time and helping us to get ready, because we couldn't be what we are today. We couldn't have been this 10 years ago. We couldn't have been this 20 years ago. And so it's the right time, and it's the right time for the world to come and see what we've done here.
Why? Why couldn't you have been this 10 years ago or 20?
Well, just as from the curatorial perspective, I might just add that there are technology that we've been able to take advantage of in the exhibitions that didn't exist 10 years ago. We've really tried to be quite aggressive in thinking that while we're building a museum that helps to channel the voices of our ancestors, that we're building a museum for the future, a museum that will benefit not only future generations, but one that children and young people would be excited to come see now. And we've got 30 media projects that are in the galleries that the technology for them did not exist. And we're just really excited for people to come and see what we've been able to do.
Give me an example of one of your favorite exhibits. I know at the moment it's like saying which one is your favorite child, but choose one that in particular the public might be excited to come to see.
So in the South Wing, we've built two inaugural exhibitions. On the main floor, we have Oklahoma, which is in our Tribal Nations Gallery, where we speak to the collective history of the 67 tribes that were removed into Oklahoma and the 39 that remain today, and how these tribes were unique, diverse, rich cultural environments and families and groups before any kind of European contact. And in fact, you asked what was exciting about that. And one of the things where we really pushed the boundaries for what our museum can do is that we worked with four tribes. And as you enter that gallery, you walk through a theater that is playing very small snippets of creation stories that four of the tribes helped us to develop and cultivate for the audiences. We wrote the gallery labels in both galleries in a first-person Indigenous voice. And in order for our audiences to understand what is different about an Indigenous perspective versus any other, we needed to help audiences understand how we see ourselves within the world and how we see ourselves fitting to the natural order that the Creator made for us. And once you come out of that, you go into a chronological section where we look at the diversity of the events that shifted our world and congested us into this space. There are, and just as a good comparison for people who are not familiar with Oklahoma, we have 39 tribes here, and our tribes come from the Pacific to the Atlantic and from the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes. And there are 39 tribes. That's not incomparable to the 44 tribes in Europe. And if you took the 44 tribes in Europe and congested them into a landscape the size of Great Britain, not even the whole of the UK, but just that one island, that would be comparable to what happened here in Oklahoma in this landscape about two centuries ago. And what our tribes have done to survive that, to resist cultural assimilation, and the really vibrant culture that lives here now. And when I say culture, I don't just mean, you know, dances and food, but the really diverse economic impacts that our tribes have. Over a quarter of all Native Americans are tribally affiliated in tribes in Oklahoma. And our second exhibition is Winneco, Life of an Object, Selections from the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. And this exhibition, we were our museum staff, and I co-curated this with Wilena Quiton, who's a member of the Osage Nation and also Muscogee Creek and Cherokee. And she had been on this project a little longer than I had and had been able to identify and become familiar with the objects that represented our 39 tribes. And she and I created a framework through which we could make selections. We then consulted back with the tribes to see if these would be appropriate to represent them out of the national collection. For many other tribes, for most of the tribes, they were acceptable, and they were actually quite proud and happy to have these objects return to Oklahoma, where many of them, the majority of them, were collected between 1908 and 1914. But there were tribes that actually refused to use the objects from the national collection, and we cooperated with those tribes to identify alternates. Because, of course, we still wanted the tribes represented. And so for the alternates, we did a range of loans from the tribal museums or tribal collections or commissions directly to their community members. But for those objects that came back from the Smithsonian to Oklahoma, we have worked with the National Museum of the American Indian, who's been a fantastic partner, to conserve them and stabilize them for travel and for a long-term exhibition. And then for nine of them, through Wilena's research in the archival notes from the collector, she was able to identify the descendants of nine of the families. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to reunite those families with those objects. And I consider this probably the height of the most critical point that our museum might take, the path our museum might take over what another museum might do. It's not simply about putting those objects on exhibition, because really anybody can do that. But for us to be able to reconnect these objects with their families, to me, that's the profound difference of Indigenous curators working in the field.
Can you talk a bit more about the tensions for a public historian, for a museum, or maybe they aren't tensions, the way that you reconcile the observation of outsiders, those to whom these objects do not belong, where there is not this either familial or tribal or sacred connection, these audiences, versus that capacity, as you just said, to return these to families and communities where they do have this particular meaning. What are the multiple goals of the museum?
Well, thank you. That's a great question, because our museum really was founded with the intention of telling the story of our tribes, and uniquely so from a Native perspective. You asked earlier, what are some of the things that have changed that make now the right time? And I would say that one of the biggest advances has been the capacity for there to be a Native American tribal member who can be experienced leader for our institution. So James Prepper Henry, who's a citizen of the Kaw Nation, also descended from the Muscogee Creek Nation. He's actually currently vice chair of his tribe as he's serving there and serving this museum. Equally so, 12 years ago, when I started curating at the University of Oklahoma, I was one of only three Native Americans curating in a non-tribal or non-federal museum. the field has expanded, and we were able to build an entirely native curatorial team to tell a story in a manner that is both bold and aggressive, in that we didn't shy away from the difficult components of our stories, but also absolutely an act of deep respect and responsibility for telling those stories that our ancestors would never have been able to have the opportunity of a museum where they would be seen as an authority. It may be the greatest honor of my career, but it was also a great burden. And figuring out how we could represent 39 tribes, our curatorial team of 11 was all tribal citizens. Really, we had to dig deep in order to be able to represent stories for tribes who were not represented by a member on the curatorial team, and especially those smaller tribes for whom there's a real dearth in the scholarship. So we're really pleased with what we've been able to do. One of the tasks I've carried for the last couple of weeks as we've been preparing to open, we actually prepared the galleries in advance to give us enough time to start taking tribal leaders through the galleries and give them a chance to see what we've done, and letting them tell us where they would like things to be improved. Not just letting them, but asking them, what would you like to do? Because we're going to be here for 100 years. This is only just the beginning. And we've got to build the relationships upon which we can rely to become an institution that is really deserving of the name of First Americans Museum.
Dr. Heather Atone, thank you for taking on this burden and this honor with such respect and reciprocity. Dr. Atone is the senior curator for the First Americans Museum and a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Dr. Atone, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
And on Sunday, a body, which authorities believe to be 22-year-old Gabby Petito, was found in Wyoming. This came after a 9-day search following the filing of a missing persons report by her family. Now, Gabby's case garnered a lot of social media and mainstream media coverage, and thank goodness it did, because it should. But many other young women who go missing barely get any attention at all. In the state of Wyoming, between 2011 and 2020, 710 indigenous people went missing. 85% of them are children, and 57% are women. According to a report released in January by the state's Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Task Force, we're going to link a great piece from the Insider up at thetakeaway.org for you, and it gets in deep on this issue. The report also shows that media coverage numbers are pretty astonishing, with only 30% of Indigenous homicide victims making the news, compared to just over half of white victims. And Indigenous women and the homicide of Indigenous women has the lowest level of newspaper media coverage, less than 1 in 5. Here to help me with all of this is Mary Catherine Nagel, partner at Pipestem and Nagel Law Firm, and it's a firm that is specializing in tribal sovereignty of Native nations and peoples. She's also a citizen of Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Welcome, Mary Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you saw the response of the FBI in the Gabby Petito case, how did you respond?
Well, you know, I mean, first and foremost, I just want to say that no family should have to go through what Gabby's family is going through. And my heart breaks for them and for her. She's lost her life. And so, you know, I speak to you today with a great amount of sorrow and compassion for her family. But when it comes to the FBI, I think what they've done for Gabby and for Gabby's family demonstrates what they are more than capable of doing for the hundreds and thousands of Indigenous women, children, and people in the United States who go missing and are murdered every, I can't speak with specific data because so many of them are mislabeled by law enforcement as suicide or runaways when, much like this unfortunate tragic case, there are incredibly suspicious circumstances. And the FBI, despite having jurisdiction over Indian country lands or reservations, tribal lands, like they do national parks, have jurisdiction, they have the capability, they have the resources in many instances, they have the technology, they have the mandate, they have the federal trust, duty, and responsibility to investigate, and they simply are not.
Okay, you've said a few things I want to make sure that we have some clarity around. So the first is, you know, in this case, even as I was introducing it, I felt that tension between being able to say and speak Gabby Petito's name, having images of her in my head from the again, heartbreaking video that we've seen of such an alive young person cut short. But I couldn't say the names. I could only give, you know, stats. Can you help us first by maybe humanizing in at least one case, an Indigenous woman or child who's missing, who we don't know what's happened?
Sure. I mean, there are so many. I could talk to you for hours. It's hard to say why, but for whatever reason, Olivia Lone Bear's case is really jumping to mind immediately. And that's probably because her brother Matthew fought for almost an entire year. I believe it was 10 months, but I might be off. It could be 11 or 12. Fought very hard to get the FBI to investigate the murder of his sister who went missing on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. FBI refused and refused and refused. Her family had to get attorneys to call then Senator Heitkamp and ask Senator Heitkamp to advocate. Senator Heitkamp then, who doesn't have direct line authority over the FBI, but as a senator in the United States Congress, said to the FBI, please investigate this missing Indigenous woman on the Fort Berthold Reservation. And her brother kept saying, search the lakes. There are so many lakes up there, man-made lakes from the Army Corps of Engineers, another catastrophe by the federal government. But put that aside, they finally, 10 months later, investigated Lake Sakakawea and dredged up her truck, which was at the bottom of the lake. And when they did that, she was seat-belted in to the passenger side alone in the truck at the bottom of the lake. This is a mother, a young mother of young children. And her brother said, there's no way she would have driven her truck, abandoned her children into the bottom of the lake. She was murdered. And the federal authorities who pulled her body out of the lake said, well, it's probably a suicide here and they're not investigating it as a homicide. So that's the kind of treatment that Native women get when they go missing. I mean, I represent the family of Kaysera Stops Pretty Places. And her body was found 5 days after she went missing in the a busy intersection in a suburban area in Hardin, Montana. I visited that spot. If you stand there, a car drives by every 15 to 30 seconds during the day. You can see the flowers and the cross that her family and friends have left there. And the FBI has said, well, the only conclusion you can draw here is that her body, she laid there for 5 days because her body was pretty badly decomposed when it was discovered. And they said, well, she just laid there for 5 days until she was discovered, even though the family insisted that her body was dropped there and that she was murdered elsewhere. Because it's just very obvious that her body would have been seen by everyone who was searching for her if her body had truly been laying there for 5 days straight, which we know it has not been. They have not done an investigation. Her body was found half a mile off the Crow Reservation border. And because her body was discovered half a mile, because their theory is that she laid there for 5 days straight, they have refused to investigate or even talk to the family, honestly, and do an interview, which would be a great first step. And they have not done that.
All right. First of all, thank you for sharing those stories, which are just brutal and shocking that they are not a regular part of our news, that we're not hearing that and talking about it and finding a way to put public pressure, right? This is part of what happens when families lose loved ones under these difficult circumstances, is that sometimes kind of that public pressure helps to push investigations forward. So the second thing that you said in your initial answer, I want to circle back to, has to do with FBI authority in on Indigenous lands. Talk to us a little bit about that. Clarify why it's the FBI who's doing these, or in this case, refusing to do these investigations.
Sure. So, you know, there's a sovereign to sovereign relationship between the tribal nations that predate the existence of the United States and the United States itself. And that is for many reasons, one of which is that when the United States first came into existence, one of the very first things this country did to legitimize its existence within the international community was sign treaties with tribal nations. And that was how it showed France, Britain, Spain, hey, we can do what you do too. We can also sign treaties with these tribal nations just like you have. Those treaties guarantee several rights, and they were, of course, made in exchange for the hundreds of millions of acres that now comprise the United States. And within those treaties are guarantees of protection and duties of protection. And as Secretary Holland has noted many times since becoming the first Native woman Secretary of the Department of Interior, those treaties contain federal trust duties and responsibilities. And President Biden has acknowledged this as well. The federal government has a federal trust duty and responsibility to the citizens of our tribal nations. And part of that is the protection, is the duty to protect from unlawful bad actors who commit these crimes and these homicides. Now, this duty is made all the more important for the FBI, which is a federal agency, to undertake its duty and its job to protect our women and children from murders and from homicides. Because in 1978, the United States Supreme Court, in a decision called Oliphant versus Suquamish Indian Tribe, erased tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who commit crimes on tribal lands. That has had a devastating impact for public safety on our tribal lands, because we know from the National Institute of Justice, a department within the Department of Justice, that the majority of violent crimes committed against Native people are committed by non-Indians. But if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in 1978, tribes do not have criminal jurisdiction, for the most part, over non-Indians who commit crimes on tribal lands. And so the reality of that today is that because of Oliphant, tribal nations are without criminal jurisdiction to prosecute the homicides committed against Native women and children perpetrated by non-Indians. We look to the federal government to do its job. And in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, it simply is not.
So, Mary Catherine, let me ask just one last question. What are the key changes from what you've seen here that need to happen from top down or from bottom up, particularly given this question of sovereignty and jurisdiction that you just discussed?
Well, I really appreciate that question, because it's one thing to talk about the problem, but we love talking about the solution because we want to save lives. I don't want to just keep appearing on these programs every time a Native woman or girl is murdered. We want to stop it from happening. And my other client that I represent on a daily basis is the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, NIWRC, headquartered in Montana. They're a national nonprofit working to end violence against Native women and girls. And one of the main goals we have is the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. We are actively working and advocating for Congress to restore the tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians that the Supreme Court took away in 1978. And we've made great progress. And of course, we got a House version of that bill, H.R. 1620, through the House. It's bipartisan. Republicans and Democrats supported restoration of tribal criminal jurisdiction for many crimes that ultimately result in homicide, including trafficking, stranger sexual assault, and child abuse, elder abuse. And that bill is stalled in the Senate right now. We have heard good news that Republicans and Democrats are trying to work together, but it has taken quite some time, and we're still advocating for the Senate to prioritize this critical bill. But I would also say that while we're working to restore tribal criminal jurisdiction, we need more funding for our tribal governments, because the federal laws that are in place, our tribal governments, tribal law enforcement, tribal victim services programs are not funded at the same levels that the state and federal are. And that's simply because in many instances, our tribal nations are not lawfully permitted to collect income tax, sales tax, property tax from anyone within their borders, the same way states are and the federal government is. And the final thing I would say is, you know, we've had, our families have struggled with United States attorney's offices and the FBI to get the respect and the treatment they deserve when one of their loved ones is murdered. I represent the family of Lindsay Whiteman. The FBI would not answer her mother's calls for help or do a real interview. They came to the funeral and tried to talk to a few people at a funeral. And when people were reluctant to talk at a funeral, they decided there was no point in doing any kind of investigation and did not come back to talk to the family further or any other eyewitnesses. 2 years later, after really not conducting an investigation, they showed up at Lindsay's brother's workplace and just showed up where he was working, there on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana and said, here is the clothing that your sister was wearing the day she died. We're done with our investigation. That's how the FBI is handling these cases. That's not going to change unless from the very top, from President Biden himself, he demands that kind of change. And in order to carry that out, you're going to have to put Native people who have experience in this specific crisis at the top echelons of the FBI and the United States Department of Justice. The Biden administration has yet to do that. And until that happens, until people who are subject matter experts and who care about prioritizing this crisis, this particular crisis, get placed at the top of those federal agencies, change will not happen in those federal agencies. It's been this way for decades, and it's going to take actual people with the subject matter expertise being placed in those spots for real change to occur.
Mary Catherine Nagel, partner at Pipestem and Nagel Law. It's a firm specializing in tribal sovereignty of Native nations and peoples. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And it was heavy. I am sending strength to all the parents and families of missing daughters. I have two daughters myself, and I don't even want to imagine the pain. Thanks for listening, guys. Remember that if you missed anything on today's show or you want to check it out again, then listen to our podcast. It's available wherever you get your audio. And of course, call us with your stories or show ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. I'm going to talk with you tomorrow.